following is a public service announcement from Just Food. Help bring live chickens into food challenge communities through your donations to the Just Food City Chicken Project 2011. The City Chicken Project would not be possible without the volunteer hours, donations large and small, and the vibrant energy and ideas of the communities we work with. Just Food is a nonprofit organization that connects New York City communities and local and urban farmers with the resources and support they need to make fresh, locally grown food accessible to all. To donate, search on Kickstarter.com for Just Food and find their City Chicken Project. For more information on Just Food, visit justfood.org or call 212-645-9880. That's 212-645-9880. Let's keep making New York City a better place to live and eat.
Boys, I'm mellow as a honeydew. Yeah, that cat is high. Look at that look in his eye. Oh man, he's high. Yes, higher than a
Welcome back to the Speakeasy. I'm your host, Damon Bolte. In the studio today, we have an old buddy of mine, cocktail pioneer and proprietor of Fort Defiance in Red Hook, Brooklyn, St. John Frizzell. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Damon.
So, obviously, you've been into this for quite a while now. You were working with some different publications, doing a little bit of writing, and you also got your chops at Pegu Club,
right?
And when I first met you, I was working down at Red Hook and at Linnell's LTD, and right across the street from there. Luckily enough, there was a great little spot called the Good Fork.
Right.
And when I was like starving to death, which I kind of liken sometimes working at Linnell's to being like a starving artist.
Right.
I would typically like run across the street and like have a quick bite and a cocktail. And as I just told you about 15 minutes ago, a very classic cocktail, The Last Word, which features gin, lime juice, green chartreuse, and maraschino liqueur. That was the first time I ever had that cocktail. I'd known about it, but I never actually had one. And I walk in one day, I was in a really big, I was in the middle of my chartreuse kick, and you made that drink for me, and it kind of changed my whole like outlook world, as far as like bartending and classic cocktails.
Yeah, that's one of those weird drinks where it's like, you know, four ingredients in equal parts and they come together really magically and don't really taste so much like one of the ingredients. They just all sort of harmoniously converge. It's really a magical drink, I think. I'm glad that you didn't have that, because at that point, you know, my chartreuse vocabulary was pretty limited. So if you had already had like, oh, no, I just had a last word, then I would have been in trouble.
you could have made me. I asked for a green chartreuse and a drink. You could have made like a bijou or something like that.
Yeah, I don't think I was making bijou.
Well, neither was I.
Yeah, right.
So this was, were you still at this time when you started bartending, were you still doing some writing?
No, well, I was doing writing. I worked at Bon Appetit magazine for 6 years. I was the promotion copy director there, so I was writing on the sales and marketing side of the magazine, doing freelance editorial stuff here and there. I had quit the magazine after 6 years, traveled through South America and China, and didn't really know what I wanted to do next at the beginning of the trip, but at the end of the trip, I decided that I wanted to, you know, to open my own spot. And to do that, I needed to get behind some good bars in New York. So I was already a big fan of the Pegu Club. I went there and I talked to Audrey. I had written about them already. And I spoke to Audrey and said, look, I really want to work here. Make me a bus boy, or I'll, you know, sweep up at the end of the night, whatever you want. Just, I really want to get behind the bar. She said, okay, go get a job at your local and work there for a year and then give me a call. So when you saw me at the Good Fork, that's what I was up to. I worked at the up the street at a bar called the Red Hook Bait and Tackle for a while.
You worked there?
I did.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Awesome. I did.
Like a really grungy beer and shop bar. Not really grungy, actually. It's
I love that cleaned table, up its act a lot. That table that has the cutout that says douchebag.
Douchebag. Yeah. Yeah. Lots of taxidermy and lots of unsavory characters and a real great bar. Worked there, then got a job at the Good Fork with my old friends Ben and Sohi, who were my landlords at the time. Worked there for a year, called Audrey and said, okay, I'm ready. She came down about 9 o'clock on a Sunday night, I think, and she sat at the bar. She ate dinner. I made her some drinks. We talked and talked and talked and talked. Everyone else left. It was just the two of us in the bar. And we finally left there at like 2 a.m. or something. And she was like, all right, why don't you come see me next week?
Cool.
So that's how I got behind the bar at the Pegu.
Cool. And that, the Pegu Club, I mean, obviously it's a legendary spot for a lot of the like top bartenders and, you know, not only in New York City, but, you know, in the United States. I mean, Toby Maloney worked there for a while.
He did, yeah. He was, I mean, the opening staff, it's like a who's who of the cocktail world now.
Totally.
It's like, it was him, Chad Solomon, Phil Ward, Brian Miller. I'm leaving some people out, but it was like it was a seriously hard-hitting crew. Yeah. Oh, Jim Meehan joined right after they opened, I think. So it's like, yeah, it's, for a while, it was a real proving ground for these guys who were going to go on and do their own thing, and I think it's really cool to see where they've all gone. They've all sort of, you know, followed their own sort of smaller interests in the cocktail world and done very well for themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can see why you would want to go there and get your chops there, you know,
yeah,
right,
well,
from the get-go.
At the time, it was really only them and Milk and Honey and like a couple other spots. And Milk and Honey was hard to get a job there. I mean, it's like a, yeah, you know, it's like joining like a secret club. You got to, it's hard. But Audrey was approachable, you know, and was, you know, kind enough to let me have a shot.
Cool. Now, something that's very interesting about like Fort Defiance and being someone in Red Hook and opening up a bar and restaurant there like Fort Defiance that's really focused on like old school, like New Orleans style, you know, not only the cocktails but also the food. Mm-hmm. You know, like I love the muffalata.
Yeah.
Like, it's like when I feel like when I'm feeling a little down, I'll go have a Sazerac and a muffalata and
yeah,
like
man,
start feeling like pretty good about myself. But coming from that literary background going into the bar, it's no wonder that one of your favorite authors is Charles H. Baker Jr.
Right.
Who wrote, and you were talking about going to South America and researching, but he wrote The Gentleman's Companion. Then a little bit later, The South American Gentleman's Companion, which is...
Right.
Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually like the writing in the South American a little bit better.
Yeah, the right, yeah.
Gentleman's Companion.
Absolutely. So like with his literary style, he was very sharp.
Yeah.
And very very witty, and he
but not brief. I mean, if
but not brief.
if brevity is the soul of wit, he managed to be not brief and also witty at the same time.
Yeah.
Somehow. But
it's
yeah,
a lot of content.
Like a famously long-winded author. I mean, why give a recipe for a drink when you can tell like a 3-page, you know, anecdote about where you found it and then throw some ingredients out?
Exactly.
I mean, he's a guy like from him I've really taken the lesson that the context of a drink is just as important as the drink itself, or
absolutely
more important. Who you have the drink with is probably the most important thing, and then where you are, what's happening around you, all of that ties into the experience. It's not just what's in the glass, it's the, you know, it's the
absolutely
whole picture.
Absolutely. And you know, a prime example of that, and to my knowledge, the only drink that specifies the direction in which it's stirred,
right,
to remember the main.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that drink for the listeners?
Yeah, the Remember the Main is a great drink. It's one of the few Charles Baker drinks that works right out of the box. I mean, it works as the directions are given, with a lot of Baker drinks, they don't. They require a little bit of tinkering.
Mm-hmm.
The Remember the Main works really well right out of the box. And yeah, he was drinking that drink in 1932, I think, in 33 in Havana, Cuba, during the Machadista uprising. He was at the Hotel Nacional while another hotel down the street where Machada was holed up with like the Olympic snipers from the Cuban Olympic team. They were being shelled, and he was down the street enjoying a really nice cocktail that he made up on the spot, and he called it the Remember the Main as a tribute to what was happening. Remember the Main was the war cry of the Spanish-American War, which happened in Cuba in 1898, and so it was sort of a reference to that, you know. But it was a drink created during wartime while shelling was actually happening. And yeah, he directs that the drink be stirred clockwise. Yeah,
because that's the direction the ships were circling it, like when they were bowing, right?
Right. Yeah, something like that. But yeah, but he does specify that the drink be stirred.
And it clockwise. I have it on my menu right now.
But, oh, nice. Yeah.
And I'm about to take it off because it was for the winter menu, but it sucks because I'm a lefty, and my natural way of stirring is counterclockwise, so I have to like stop every once in a while and remind myself, oh, God.
You know, not to get too geeky here, but I'm right-handed, and I naturally stir
counterclockwise. Really?
I have no idea why. I haven't seen anyone else do it that way. Everyone else stirs clockwise except me. I don't know why. I just...
Weird.
It just naturally...
You're weird.
Me. Yeah, I know.
So, yeah, well, getting back to the literary connection there and the cocktail side, it's like Charles C. Baker, he wasn't really necessarily like a mixologist or a bartender.
No. He was like the Ben Franklin of the bartending world. He was like a writer, a philosopher, you know, never an elected official. Ben Franklin, you know, was never elected to anything, but he was always in the mix.
Yeah.
And Charles Baker was he was an intellectual, he was a diplomat, he was a sportsman, he was an adventurer, world traveler.
He was a bon vivant.
Absolutely a bon vivant, but never spent an hour behind a bar, except at his own house. I mean, you know, he entertained a lot. He lived in Coconut Grove, Florida, in the 30s, when Coconut Grove was a real artist colony.
Yeah.
And it was like a lot of weirdos hanging out there, and artists and writers. He was hanging out with Robert Frost and band leaders, you know, published authors. He was a good friend of Fred Waring, who invented the blender. He was a band leader as well, and he invented the blender. So he was a big proponent of the Waring blender, and he traveled around the world numerous times, 3 cruises around the world, numerous trips to South America, Central America, Europe. You know, it was all over the place.
I really wish we could do that these days.
I know.
Oh my God, I'm so jealous. When we get back from this break that we're about to take, I want to talk a little bit more about that, but I also want to talk about Fort Defiance and the inspiration behind the New Orleans style cocktails. And let's talk a little bit about like the I love the backstory that you were telling me earlier about the sumo Collins that is actually featured in the New York Times today, right now. We have a copy here. We're going to talk about that and the kind of tongue-in-cheek giganticness of this awesome Collins when we get back. All right.
I'm the last of the best. They call me the greedy man. Got many clients. Come from miles around, running down my prescription. I got medicine to cure all y'all's ills. I got remedies of every description. I got it now.
Green, green, gumbo.
got love troubles. You got a bad woman you can't control. I got just the thing for you. Something called controlling hearts and get-together drops. If you work too hard...
The following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Every Sunday at 4:30 p.m., tune in to Burning Down the House. Architecture is the laser focus of Burning Down the House, a weekly discourse on all things built, destroyed, admired, and despised. Each week, Curtis B. Wayne, your host, invites a posse of authors, critics, builders, designers, and other architecture fiends to reflect on various topics related to perhaps the most functional of all art forms. Again, that's every Sunday at 4:30 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
That was Grigé Gomoyaya from Dr. John, which totally is taking me... Totally taking me down south, man. Speaking of going down south, we were just talking before the break about... you know what? While we were just on this break, we were just talking about how that's your, like, your meditation, like, on your way to work.
Yeah.
Every bartender has a different kind of, like, meditation, like, before they start their shift.
Right.
And it's extremely important. You gotta, like for me, it's like, I have to have like a coffee, gotta have lunch for an hour,
right,
and then like maybe like read the paper or whatever. I mean, like, but like Gary Regan talks about, like, when he was like first bartending when he was like 17 or 18 years old, like sitting in the corner and he wouldn't allow anyone to talk to him, and like that was his meditation.
Yeah.
Everyone has it. Toby Giacchini, like in his book,
I was just about to mention Toby.
Yeah, he was talking about in his book about going down to the basement and changing his work clothes, and that was like his ritualistic, you know, like meditation,
right,
time,
yeah,
before he started his shift. And that's like that song that we just played on the break. That's your version of it.
Yeah,
listening to that on the way to work.
Well, Toby worked at Fort Defiance for like a hot second.
Really?
Yeah, he did. Awesome. Oh, dude, you should have been there for that. That was quite a show. Because you know, we do a pretty high volume on the weekends, and just watching him do all that was really, really funny. A great guy, a really lovely, lovely man, who eventually left. He was just like, I'm too old for this, I can't do this anymore.
Too old for this
my
shit.
Back hurts, it takes me 3 days to recover. But a beautiful, beautiful man. A lot of the time I think you want to get fired up before work, and you'll listen to something really high energy. With me, it's the opposite, because we serve brunch and we're open all day, and we don't have a time when you can come in and change into your work clothes
and like set up the bar,
quietly, and all that stuff doesn't exist, especially on weekends. So if Saturday night, Sunday night, we're coming off an insane brunch, when I come in, the place is always at least half full, and yeah, the brunch staff is trying to pick up the pieces of, you know,
yeah,
what just happened. And so I need to listen to something that kind of puts me into like a sedated mood, like a dream state.
You need to like calm it down a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I hear and that. Like, so I can come in with that song kind of ringing in my head and deal with the chaos around me and just, you know, be cool.
Cool. You know, we were talking before the break about like the connection of Fort Defiance and the New Orleans connection.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I lived in New Orleans for 8 great years. I was there, you know, I moved there when I was 18 to go to Tulane, and ended up hanging around Roll Green Wave, and ended up hanging around for a few years after, which, you know, which happens to people in New Orleans.
Yeah.
And worked in the service industry, worked in some restaurants, did some house painting, did this and that. And absolutely love the city, go back at least once a year, and I still think the way that I eat and drink and approach life is very informed by what I learned there.
Yeah. You
know, by the lifestyle.
And that's like with certain drinks, like certain classic cocktails, like the Sazerac, the Ramos Gin Fizz, like all the, like the De La Louisiane, the Vieux Carré, these are all like born out of New Orleans. These are like, right, serious classic cocktails. And you don't really, like, most people don't really think of New Orleans as being like an influential cocktail city. You think about San Francisco and obviously New York City, maybe a little bit of Los Angeles, but not really. I mean, not till like later on, until like the Cock and Bull with the Moscow Mule, which was like, come on, dude.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But it's like the culture there and the history is so crazy. It's such a dense history. There's so much stuff that happened in New Orleans within the history of the United States. I mean, yeah. Like, Jesus, like, the Reverend Elijah Craig developed bourbon, putting White Dog into charred barrels floating down the Mississippi to New Orleans. That's how bourbon was invented. And, like, it's, like you said, like, the food and the culture and everything, like I said before earlier, too, is like, the muffalata is, like, one of my favorites.
Yeah.
But,
well, yeah. You know, it's a port city, always has been, like a you know, vitally important port city, New Orleans, so you have people from all over the place coming in and out constantly. That makes a great city and a very vibrant one. With the food and the drink stuff, there's always been a great emphasis placed on social life in New Orleans, for better and for worse. Like, there's more of an emphasis placed on social life than there is on business and industry.
Yeah.
You know, which doesn't always work out in the city's favor, but it's there. And even when I go back to visit, there's a great emphasis placed on social life. And by that, I mean, you know, spending time with your friends and your family and, you know, celebrating holidays and inventing, you know, your own holidays to celebrate. I've always said that New Orleans is the only city that I know with its own soundtrack. Just living there.
Yeah.
For a few years, you learn, I'd say, about 60 songs that you might not know the names of, but you know them by heart because you hear them all the time. They're just part of the
vocabulary there. Yeah,
and totally. and most people there know what a Sazerac is, and that's not because they're cocktail geeks. It's just because they go out to eat and they see other people drinking it, and their fathers drank it or their mothers drank it, mm-hmm. and it's just part of the culture. It's not. Cocktails is now becoming a little bit fatty down there, but they've always been around down there.
Yeah. I mean,
they've really never gone away.
You know, something about, like you were just saying, like the fatty kind of thing with cocktails and whatnot. It's like there are a lot, like, this market is kind of, in a way, it's like the actual, like, kind of like cocktail bar scene is like really saturated, but it's saturated with, unfortunately, I'm just going to say this, it's unfortunately saturated with a lot of bartenders that don't necessarily know what they're doing with these. A lot of new bartenders are getting into this because they want to have the title of a mixologist, and you never call yourself a mixologist. Like, you never call yourself a rock star. You let other people call you, you know. Those are titles that you don't give yourself. You let other people give them to you. And in the New York Times today, I love this because it goes back to, like, just straight up, like, it brings up the very, like, fun side of making cocktails, but also, like, the simplicity. Like, simplicity in cocktails is so key. Like, think about, you know, like the Sazerac. It's basically three ingredients with a rinse of one.
Right.
And, you know, all these, like, we were talking before the show, we were talking about, like, you know, simplicity in cocktails. And, like, what do bartenders drink when they're not,
right,
you know, at work? You know, and a lot of them will admittedly say that, you know, they're into beers and shots and whatnot. Just like we had before the show.
Yep.
But it's great. This is a really cool article today in the New York Times about, it's titled, "Here's to Your Summer, Cocktails Made Simpler." And you have a really awesome quote in here talking about how, you know, something as simple as like the Tom Collins. You know, you can add, like you said, you can add 7 or 8 ingredients to it. But really, when it gets down to it, this is just a great drink on its own. And what you've done,
right?
You've made it. It's 3 ounces gin, 2.5 or 2.25 ounces fresh lemon juice, an ounce and a half simple syrup, a shitload of chilled seltzer, and an orange wheel. And it's called the Sumo Collins, which is available at Fort Defiance.
Yeah,
and tell Sumo us why. Collins. Tell us why this happened.
Yeah. Okay. So Dave Wondrich came by my bar before it was open and said, we were talking about the menu and stuff and what I was going to serve. And he said, he told me one of my favorite things that I've ever heard, which is if he opened his bar, I don't know if you ever heard this. He would serve two things. He would serve lemonade and he would serve old fashions, and he would make the lemonade with the lemons that he was doing the
peels
twist, yeah, for the old fashioned. So he would do a whiskey old fashioned and a lemonade. And if he really liked you, he'd make you punch, which is pouring the old fashioned into the lemonade.
That's awesome.
So we were talking about that kind of stuff, and he said, you know what? You should serve a really big Collins here. Like, you know, you're down in Red Hook. It takes a long time to get there, whether you're on the bus or whether you're walking or riding your bike. In the summertime, it's really hot. And by the time people get there, it takes twice as long as you think. This is a really bad advertisement for my bar right now.
But no, I think it's beautiful.
But once you get down there, you really want something that's thirst-quenching. And if it's busy, you don't want to have to grab the bartender 5 minutes after you just ordered a drink, because you're going to suck down that first one.
Right.
So why not make a really big Collins? So,
well, it's just like what we were talking about on the way over here. It's talking about, like, we will sit around and drink a beer, maybe have a shot, and we'll chill out on that. But for us, nowadays, going to bars, it's like when we have a cocktail, it's like we just end up sucking it down.
Yeah.
Way too fast.
I drink them way too fast. Yeah. I was drinking them way too fast last night.
Yeah.
But
I think we all were.
Yeah. But
Studio smells like sweat and booze.
So this is like, you know, it's a really big Collins. It's served in a big 25. I found a 24-ounce Collins glass. And the drink goes in that, and you get a big thing. Now, it's called Sumo. You know, besides the obvious reasons, I was in Hawaii right before I opened and went to a place called, Ken's House of Pancakes in Hilo. And they serve, you know, crazy things.
Very intriguing name.
In Hawaii, like Loco Moco and Simon and stuff like these like real, like local, like very starch heavy Hawaiian foods. And they come in huge bowls. But then I was sitting there at the counter and a bell rang and the whole staff shouted Sumo, and this giant bowl of Simon came out and went out to one of the tables, and I was like, wow, this must be somebody's birthday or that's something awesome. 5 minutes later, ding ding ding, Sumo, another bowl went out, ding ding ding, Sumo, all day long. It was like these giant Hawaiians were eating giant bowls of food. So I was like, yeah, I'll just call it the Sumo Collins. And
that's awesome.
Yeah, it's a oversized Tom Collins. That's it.
I love that. I love that. That's actually going to be my new meditation when I go into the bar. You know, on the flip side of that, though, I was in Fort Defiance. Let's see. What was that? Sunday. It was Sunday.
Yeah.
I was there, and you made a drink for me from New Orleans, from Josh.
From Paul Gustings.
Paul Gustings. This Angostura Sour.
Yeah.
At Two Jacks, right?
Yeah. I had gone down there in December and met Paul and was hanging out with him. And when he lightened up, when he decided that he liked me, he started to make some really good drinks. And one of them, I swore this was the best drink I ever had. And it was called the Angostura Sour. It's a full ounce of Angostura. He was using Angostura rum, a lemon syrup, some acid phosphate, and some St. Elizabeth's allspice dram. And this thing just knocked my socks off. It was a full ounce of Angostura, but it was not bitter, really. I mean, it's got that bitterness, but it was just like had an incredibly deep flavor, but was also refreshing because the acid phosphate kind of lightens the whole thing up and turns up the volume on certain flavors in it without getting in the way. It's just like, it's a phenomenal drink. I make them. I think they're good at my shop, but not as good as Paul's, just for the record. I think Paul's are a little bit better.
You know, like we were talking about that before too, before the show, about like how when we go out and have a cocktail, it's like, it's kind of like, nowadays for us, maybe we're a little bit jaded, but we look for the things on the menus that the cocktails on the menus, we look for ingredients that just jump out at you, like things like acid phosphate or like an ounce of Angostura bitters,
right?
Or a 24 ounce right. Tom Collins, and then we go for that. And I think that that's like the greatest thing. But I want to go back to the Sumo Collins real quick. I love that because especially like guys like us that are typically like on a day-to-day basis very dehydrated, right. Like right now, you want to suck down a 24-ounce Tom Collins or Sumo Collins rather.
Yeah.
And I love that Dave Wondrich in all his glory suggested that, and I'm glad that you did it. Yeah. And I cannot wait to come down there to Red Hook and have one at Fort Defiance.
Anytime, man.
It's been really great having you on the show today.
Yeah, it's been fun, Damon.
And we're definitely going to have another show with you because
yeah, I know, feel like a lot that we didn't talk about.
There's a lot that we haven't talked about. But yeah, awesome. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks to my producer, Jack Inslee. We'll see you next week. Cheers.
Yeah, that cat is high. Look that look in his eye. Oh man, he's high. Yes, higher than a kite. That cat is high.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
Yes, he's high. Man, he's higher than a guy.
This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer. This week, all over the internet and also in all of the meat trade papers, as well as in this particular article on digital trends, a story has been running about the poop burger. Japanese scientists have found a way to create artificial meat from sewage containing human waste. Mitsuyuki Ikeda, a researcher from the Okayama Laboratory, has developed steaks based on proteins from human excrement. Tokyo Sewage approached the scientists because of an overabundance of sewage mud. They asked him to explore the possible uses of the sewage, and Ikeda found that the mud contained a great deal of protein because of all the bacteria. The researchers then extracted those proteins, combined them with a reaction enhancer, and put it in an exploder, which created the artificial steak. The meat is 63% proteins, 25% carbohydrates, 3% lipids, and 9% minerals. The researchers color the quote-unquote meat red with food coloring and enhance the flavor with soy proteins. Initial tests have suggested people say that it even tastes like beef. This has been Behind the Scenes Food News with Kate Kiefer.
Check out a small clip from The Food Scene hosted by Michael Harlan Turkel, a show where food and art intersect.
I think most recently you had a chocolate waterfall that had 5 tons of chocolate flowing, and you'd put on, a protective suit, walk through a waterfall, yeah. Make your own chocolates within this kind of contained environment. And most recently, a rabbit cafe.
Yep.
Can you explain that one to me a little bit?
Well, I'm... And this also slightly comes from jellies as well, because in England, everyone has these rabbit jelly molds. It's the most popular mold. Everyone goes, oh, I had rabbit jellies as a kid. And we've always been utterly bewildered by it. Why rabbit jellies? The only way to get to the bottom of it was to get a whole herd of rabbits, open a cafe with them, and have people touch rabbits and eat.
Yeah.
So it kind of has resonance with one of our favourite cookbooks, which we think an awful lot of modern chefs have is their dark secret under their pillow, which is the futurist.
Want to hear more? Well, tune into The Food Scene live every week, Tuesdays at 3 p.m., or you can find all the archive shows on our website or subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. Thanks for listening. The following is a message from Zingerman's. From June 30th to July 3rd, 2011, come hang out at Camp Bacon, a 4-day festival hosted by Zingerman's. The main event is an all-day affair at Zingerman's Roadhouse featuring plenty of bacon, bacon learning, and such luminaries as Alan Benton, John T. Edge, Molly Stevens, and more. The event will be taking place in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Proceeds from this event benefit Southern Foodways Alliance. Also, on Friday, July 1st, there'll be a special benefit performance featuring Andre Williams and the Gold Stars and special guest John Langford and Skull Orchard. Visit www.zingermanscampbacon.com for more information and for tickets. Once again, that's www.zingermanscampbacon.com.